Welcome to the Brain Health Mission podcast, exploring how science, policy, and everyday choices shape the health of your brain and what you can do to protect it.
Hello, and welcome back to the Brain Health Mission podcast, where we explore the science, the strategies, and the stories behind brain health in neurology. I'm your host, Dr. Jana Middelfart-Hoff, neurologist and treasurer of the European Academy of Neurology. In today's episode, we are looking into the connection between what you eat and brain health, or perhaps what you eat is who you are. We will together explore the term brain-gut connection, and luckily I have two expert guests in the studio to do so together with me, Suzanne Dixon and Hans Törnblom. Welcome to both of you. Before we enter into the field of nutrition and brain health, perhaps you could give a brief introduction of yourselves. Who are you? Ladies first, Suzanne.
Hello, everyone. So my name is Suzanne Dixon, and I'm a professor in the Department of Physiology at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. That's all despite my Scottish origins, as you may hear. My research area is on gut-brain signaling by gut hormones. I'm especially interested in appetite regulation. Currently the president of the European Brain Council. So this is an advocacy and policy organisation which is interested in lobbying for brain health and brain research.
So having you here is like having a Columbine egg. We have both the president of the European Brain Council and also one of the most known researchers in the brain gut field. So that is super. And then we have a fellow citizen of yours, and also in Sweden, but with a Swedish accent. Hans, who are you?
This was a strange coincidence. So I'm also a resident. I'm also living in Gothenburg, Sweden. I'm an associate professor of gastroenterology at the Department of Internal Medicine at Sahlgrenska Academy. It might seem a bit odd to have me as a guest in the context of brain health, but I label myself as a neurogastroenterologist since my clinical and research practice is focused around disorders of gut-brain interaction, a group of disorders that previously was labeled functional gastrointestinal disorders, which is an area where brain health is a factor of central importance and growing understanding. Among many things, my research has focused on the effects of dietary interventions in DGBI, IBS in particular. And in this context, I write and lecture about neuromodulation as a therapeutic measure in patients with chronic GI symptoms, abdominal pain in particular. And relating to my bicycle in the background, that is one of my main interests in how I neuromodulate my own brain by going back and forth to work, among other things. Cool it down.
That is a very wise move of you, Hans. And to be physically active, of course. But the episode and this theme is about the brain and the gut. And that wasn't so known many years ago, but now we see that there is a connection there. But I thought we go to from scratch. And let us start with the British author, Nigella Lawson. I love her cooking books. And she long ago published the book, How to Eat. But I think that the eminent question in this episode first is, why do we eat? What is actually the purpose of eating? And has not only the food, but also the pattern of eating of mankind changed over time? That we do eat in a different way than our ancestors when they were collecting berries and hunting for mammoths. Can you say something about that? Why we eat and how we eat today? I thought, Suzanne, I challenge you on that first.
Sure. Well, as a foodie, I love this question. I mean, of course, we eat to sustain life. It's one of the basic physiological principles, and it's absolutely necessary. Our physiology is set up to sustain life. It provides the energy for all our body processes, you know, everything, powering the brain, the muscles, and building and repairing tissues. So we need a constant supply of nutrients, and we need diverse nutrients in order to maintain our natural, our internal balance for our vital functioning. regarding how it's changed over time, well, I mean, of course, what our ancestors ate, Nigella's quite right, and what we eat today is really quite different. Our ancestors would have eaten rather opportunistically, depending on what food is available. And, you know, they're going between times of famine and feasting. And, of course, we're evolved to survive famine by overeating when food becomes available. And today, of course, in our modern lifestyle, food is available 24/7. And globalization means that we have a huge diversity of nutrients available to us. The pattern of our eating can also be considered because we can decide when we eat, whereas our ancestors, I mean, if they find a wild animal and they kill it, that's their main energy source, and they will overeat and store energy for a future famine. We don't need to do that today, fortunately, in the Western world. But of course, things like geography and season, ecology, you know, these impact on how we eat in our modern lifestyle. And we need to continually adapt to our environment.
You have something to add, Hans?
I mean, basically what Susanne has already said is the important part of it. We eat to survive. We need energy. We need building materials to sustain our body and develop as humans. But I mean, we also have a unique feature when it comes to other species, that we eating has always been far more than biological as well. It's a social bonding thing to do. It also signals cultural identity, rituals, pleasure, even political expression today, which is not unimportant, I would say. So eating has developed it into something completely different to what it used to be, like Suzanne told us about. And even if we have too much food in most of the world today, the diversity of food, what we eat, has been dramatically reduced. And we don't follow these seasonal patterns anymore. That probably is also have effects on our health and general.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is thus that we still have the thing that we think we need to overeat in order to fight the future famine, but the famine is not coming in the Western countries, and still we overeat, so we're having the patterns of our ancestors, but a completely different option for nutrition. Well, that's very interesting. We're going to delve a little more into that later, but the reason that we chose the theme and are so happy to have you with us is that few things create so much emotions and confusions as the term. You already mentioned a little bit about that, a so-called healthy diet. What to eat? We talked about pattern, but what should you eat in order to eat healthy? And there are so many experts, wannabe experts, who claim that they have the truth and that their diet is the only way for a healthy lifestyle, including a healthy brain. And, you know, and sometimes it's quite confusing because there are so many contradictory advices. You should eat meat, you should eat less meat, you should eat no meat, you should fast, no carbo, low carbo, you know the drill. And in your opinion, are there any features that are not controversial which characterize a healthy diet? And what are these?
This is a difficult question that also involves what I said, like political aspects, and very much it's a little bit like religion, that there are believers and non-believers in what a healthy diet is. And sometimes it's very important, very difficult to leave your standpoint, to kill your darling, so to say. But if we look upon different definitions of healthy diet as we know it for now, there is a few areas, at least some broad principles, where I think there is good agreement, both from a scientific, cultural, and political point of view, like eat mostly minimally processed food, whole food, eat plenty of vegetables and fruits, try to minimize the modern type of ultra-processed foods, even if it's not a genuinely evidence-based recommendation. I think that is what most people agree on. Minimize added sugars, particularly when it comes to what you drink. Sugary drinks, and eat sufficient amounts of fiber, which is, I think, in industrial countries is one of the big problems. There are several structural problems that make nutritional science and these types of recommendations genuinely difficult, because I mean, what we recommend are based on mostly observational studies in humans, at least. And it's notoriously difficult to understand what people eat, at least adults. And there is confounding everywhere, since, I mean, healthy eating is almost always associated with other lifestyle measures that has effects on health. Exercise, for example, and other lifestyle choices that affects the outcome of your life.
Suzanne, you have something to add to that?
Well, I wish I knew what a healthy diet was, because I would be implementing it. But I mean, Hans is quite right. These are so-called epidemiological studies where, you know, you look at very large populations of people and look for evidence that if people tend to eat certain foods, then they are healthier. But there's so many confounding factors like exercise and, you know, lifestyle. If you tend to eat a healthy diet, you tend to maybe have other healthy routines. You know, but there is a general principle here, in that where there is a consensus that in what we should be eating. And I wouldn't like to favour any single diet. You know, it needs to be balanced in all our essential nutrients and is based mostly on whole or minimally processed foods. It's not really one magic approach. I mean, you hear all these different types of diets like low-carb, plant-based, intermittent fastings, and they all work, because usually we're reducing overall, you know, the amount of food that we're eating. But I mean, I think it's also an interesting thing, is a related question, if you like, that I would raise is, you know, why is it, although we may have information about what is a healthy diet, why we don't implement it? And it might seem, why is it so difficult? And again, I would like to come back to our ancestors, because of course, I wanted to get a little bit into the topic of food reward, and that we find food rewarding. And, you know, if you're on a diet, your body's craving food and you're thinking, oh my, and it's gone into starvation mode, I must eat. And then of course, you'll really want to take in a diversity of foods from your environment and take as much food as you can. And in fact, part of this is, you know, to find food rewarding means that we look for foods that we find rewarding. And our ancestors, I mean, it might have been healthy berries and other things in the environment that they find rewarding, and meat is rewarding if you've not had it, and so on. So finding foods rewarding helps us to go out into our environment and get a variety of nutrients. And that's really important for sustaining our nutrition. But in our modern lifestyle, of course, the food industry is set up to make foods as rewarding as they ever can be. And of course, who wouldn't be tempted by the huge diversity of foods that are available? It's hard to stick to those diets, even with the best intentions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true. And isn't it also the case that we are very much lured by the combination fat and sugar, for instance? And I mean, one thing is that we have a lot to buy, but maybe many of the things are a variation of the same theme. So that is what you were talking about, Hans, that we have a diversification in food, but still maybe we eat less different due to seasons and so on that we used to, because we have the access to the same food the whole year. We have strawberries in December, and we have so you don't change as much as you used to. But could you say, because I have to admit that, and I know it's not good for me, and that's the advantage, as you say, of all those bias factors, that I have a higher education, naturally I'm concerned about brain health and so on, so I don't eat croissants
to every meal or so on. But of course, I see how my brain reacts when I go to a bakery and I'm supposed to buy, you know, a bread that is full of grain and so on. And they have this wonderful smell of butter combined with a little note of sugar, you know. Of course, my brain is very much lured by that. And of course, if I had the free choice and not the conscience, I would love to buy that. But I can sort of adjust myself and regulate it. And I also found the pleasure in eating high grain bread. But isn't that something that we have in our brains as a sort of pattern, that certain combinations that are especially full of calories due to sort of avert the famine are tempting to us?
I really don't know the answer to that, if we have that in our brain, but our behaviors definitely are in that direction. And I mean, when it comes to what defines healthy eating today, I think if you were just to give one advice, that probably would have a good effect on a large part of the population, is that do not overeat. I think many of the dietary advice that is given today is a little bit too technical and misses out on basic aspects that in the end relates to that we eat a bit too much, reflected also in the growing problem with obesity. So I mean, the simple context is often not sexy enough to catch on for people. You need to eat a little bit less. Like you said, the croissant is good, but you can stick with one croissant and perhaps not every day, even if I also tend to eat croissant day if it is available.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I also think that it is important to say to people that if you buy unhealthy food, if you buy a lot of chocolate and have them stored in your home or sweets or whatever, you're more prone to eat them. If you put in some hindrance to, yeah, Suzanne?
For sure, it's important to control what you eat. But I wanted to come back a little bit to the sugar fat question, because I mean, here's the thing, you know, we have butter in our fridge. You know, we could take it out of the fridge, but I mean, how many of us find ourselves with a spoon or a knife, you know, cutting into the butter and supping it? And the same is true of sugar cubes. You know, you go to get yourself a cup of coffee in the lunchroom, and you know there's a bowl of sugar cubes sitting there. And who of us decides, oh, I would love to have a sugar cube? And there's something about combining fat and sugar that increases the palatability. And then if you add, of course, things like cocoa, then you get that perfect mixture that just, you know, what do you say, dissolves in your mouth at 37 degrees centigrade, your body's temperature, and gives you a really rewarding experience. You know, we blame the food industry, but they're clever. They know how to make that perfect mixture. And I was once involved in a project where I had the opportunity to meet people from the food industry, and I was very suspicious. I thought, you know, they're putting things in our diet to make it, you know, make it more palatable and make us consume more. But I think it is the combinations, is my conclusion. And on top of fat and sugar and cocoa, you can add salt. I mean, who doesn't love, you know, these ice creams that have salt added to them, or chocolate with salt added to them? So they figured out what is most rewarding for us, and they heavily market it, of course. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah, I can add on to that. I mean, I've also had contact with the food industry, and I mean, they have a genuine problem as companies that has to make a profit. We had contact with one of the large yogurt producers in the world, and I mean, they genuinely wanted to shift a bit when it came to sugar content in their yogurts. So they had a low sugar yogurt provided, but they had to take it out of the market since it didn't sell. People didn't buy it, even if they advertised it and said that this is a more healthy yogurt compared to the other one. It didn't sell enough. So they say, we do have a problem.
Yeah, that is really interesting, yeah. So, of course, it's definitely, as you are saying, Suzanne, it's
consumer behavior. It's all those combinations that we sort of love to eat. And of course, it's also the industry taking advantage of neuroscience and of expertise in your field and creating these things that we know we are going to be very intrigued by. Not only easy to swallow, but also the sound it makes and the familiarity of consistency and so on. So there are many things to fight in order to sustain a healthy lifestyle and not to overeat, for instance. But I wanted to discuss with you, because I'm a neurologist and I know what I define as a healthy brain. That means a brain that is effective in your daily life, that so that you can do your job, your hobbies, and so on. But what's actually a healthy gut, in your opinion? And when does a gut become unhealthy, if we can say it that way? What kind of problems are arising then, and why? Could you dare to say something about that, Hans?
There are key characteristics of a healthy gut that should be present. If we just go for, the hot topic now is microbial diversity, which seems to be one of the aspects that is associated with a healthy gut, that you actually have a high microbial diversity, where the gut in itself has a function that creates stability and resilience to change, insult does not affect the long-term stability of gut function. And from that point, the next level is also the intact gut barrier function, which is something that is, there's a lot of fuss about leaky gut and so on. And many people really do not understand that the gut should be leaky. Otherwise, we would not survive. But the scientific discussion is there instances where an increased leakage actually creates a problem in the long run, or perhaps an insult with a brief situation of more leakiness perhaps can activate immunological and humoral activities that creates a problem in the long run. So the intact gut barrier function is probably also of importance, and also the immune system. And the largest part of the body's immune system resides along the gut lining. The gut is more or less an invagination of your outside. As long as something is still inside your gut, it's actually not inside you. It's just passing through, which is a mind-boggling situation. the immune system, and there you can say the stability of the immune activity. I wouldn't say the inflammatory state, but the immune activity should be stable over time and react consequently when you have some kind of intruder, and then behave well in between. So some kind of absence of what you can define as inflammation. And also other factors like the motor function, things need to go through your bowels. That is, it's such a basic thing. I deal with neuromuscular diseases in the gut where you actually get symptoms of stagnation, ileus more or less, even if you don't have a mechanical problem. You need to have a good propagating activity going on in your bowels, which also creates a stable environmental milieu that creates, you can say, the foundation for health.
That's very true. And that is, if you are constipated, if what you're having in your gut is not passaging, then of course it can get unhealthy.
But that is actually, that it's good that you bring that up, because constipation is not actually a marker of something, a disease state in the true sense that it actually connected to different health outcome in the long run. It's more something that creates, it affects your quality of life for many people, but it's actually not causing a stagnation that has significant impact on your health, as we can see in epidemiology and so on. If you have constipation, which most often is something that is related, that one is related to the colon, which is important from a nutritional point of view, but that doesn't mean that your small bowel has any problems with digesting and absorbing. Many people with constipation actually have a major problem with letting go, the passage through the bowel. When you have your bowel movement, to be able to coordinate an increase in abdominal pressure by straining, and at the same time relaxation in the muscles of alongside your rectum. And that is something that most of us, we don't need to think about it. But if you're constipated, you lose that coordination also as part of it. So it's very troublesome being constipated, no doubt on that. But it's not dangerous in the sense that many patients think or fear that there is toxins gathering or something like that.
That was very comforting. And it's definitely argument for treating constipations as something that is very unpleasant and should be through fiber and so on, but it's not dangerous. So that is nice for me and the listeners to know. Suzanne, what is a healthy gut to you?
Well, I have to put on my personal hat rather than my expert hat here. And I suppose I've learned a lot that fiber in the diet is super good, and probably it plays a role scientific evidence, I think, supports its role in supporting this healthy gut microbiota in the gut, and of course helps with all the issues that we've been hearing about related to constipation. A healthy gut, of course, you would like to think that's one that supports brain function in a positive way also. And I think, you know, this is an open door to try to understand how a healthy gut impacts on mood and cognition and, you know, well-being. And I think, you know, there's a lot of research going on in that field. My gut in my lab is all about producing hormones. And, you know, I think that we shouldn't forget that it's important to have a good balance of hormones. I mean, you have to realize that, you know, in your day you eat several meals and you nibble between meals. And the biggest controller of that is your gut. It's the hormones that we produce in different parts of our gut that are telling the brain, okay, it's now it's time to eat, or now it's time to stop eating, or, you know, just in between meals, I'm not terribly hungry right now, but so I'm satiated. And this is all controlled by your gut. So if you have a good, what do you say, crosstalk between these hormones that you're continually producing in different points in your day according to your meals, to have them in balance is really important.
In this podcast, we challenged our experts to do some myth busting. And especially in this field, as we already discussed, there are plenty of myths about fantastic diets or things you could do. I mean, you could just eat an avocado a day and you would suddenly have the IQ of a Nobel Prize winner, you know, all these things. And I invite you to bust a myth with me, or to break up with a misconception. And Hans, if I start with you, would you share something with the listeners and say, this is commonly spread and it's not true? Don't believe the hype.
Mm. Well, in my clinical area of expertise, one of the, I would say, myths that is also adopted by many of the clinicians today, and there's more, it's a scientific argument going on, or a more or less a war, when it comes to the clinical implications of our microbiota composition in the small bowel. When I studied medicine in the mid-80s, we learned about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which is a true phenomenon, that you actually can have situations where you contract disease from having too many microorganisms in your small bowel. But that is still related to having a severe problem in your small bowel that actually can make that happen, like having a stricture or having a severe neuromuscular disease that actually makes things not being able to go through at the correct speed, that bacterial growth actually can go on there. But what is very, very popular today is to be treated for SIBO. I think it's very different in the different countries. And this is a concept that we have a lot to learn about. And I'm not convinced that we should call it SIBO. There are probably variations in gut microbiota balance that might be of interest. We don't know if it's a cause of an effect. And the way it now is diagnosed by having different types of carbohydrates ingested, and watch how much hydrogen or methane that is exhaled through your mouth, is actually not a good way of diagnosing it. It's actually a measure, originally a measure of transit time. If you have a carbohydrate that you don't digest, it travels through your gut and reaches the colon. And when it reaches the colon, a lot of fermentation will be going on from your gut microbiota in the colon and will produce hydrogen and methane. We don't produce them ourselves if we don't consider the microbiota as part of ourselves, which we probably should. But it's a microbiota production. So you use a measure for transit to say you seem to have bacterial overgrowth or your small bowel, and you treat these patients with antibiotics to a large extent in some parts of the world. And I think that is a major mistake we are making today. So I would say SIBO as a clinical diagnosis is definitely used in a dangerous way right now. If I had other colleagues sitting beside me, I would be contested that I'm wrong. But I would say if you go for the safety part of being a doctor, not harming, I think we're doing stupid things when it comes to this right now in parts of the world.
Could you just say again, Hans, what SIBO stands for?
Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And that is also, I mean, from my point of view, most patients that ask me about that, they have IBS or similar problems, irritable bowel syndrome. But it also used as an putative explanation and treated as such for like chronic fatigue or being some kind of blurry sensation in your head or looking for explanations for difficult to treat depression and so on. And I think it's a major mistake to translate what we know today when it comes to microbiota composition and so on and think that we can understand if it's a cause or an effect.
Mm-hmm. So in this episode, we are busting the myth that it's the bacteria in your small bowel that is causing the problems. And at least I think you are having an extremely important point. We have so much problems in the world with antibiotic resistance for infections that are life-threatening and that we at some point will not be able to treat because we have got so resistant to the treatment that we have available. So to be careful in what we are treating with antibiotics, and especially if the bacteria, as you say, are ours and probably not something strange. So that was a very wise thing.
I can just add on a minor thing there. It's not only how we treat it, but also that you give the patient a concept of disease that perhaps is wrong. You're explaining their symptoms with something that actually is not true. It's also something that is important, that you shouldn't label a patient with a diagnosis or an explanation if you don't have better evidence for that actually being true. Because having too many bacteria in your bowels, that sounds really dangerous.
Yeah, that sounds scary. That's unlike Indian, you know, yeah.
That it's due to that they you should use it. I would be scared if someone said that to me. If I was,
I would be extremely scared. Yeah. I'm a neurologist. Yeah. Suzanne, what is your favorite myth to bust in this episode?
Yeah, so I'm going to move to the brain. Okay, so it's quite common. You commonly read in the press that you know food is addictive and that people are addicted to foods. And so I've really been involved in projects, research projects, looking into this. And what I can say is that there is no single ingredient in food or combination of ingredients in food, and not even caffeine, by the way, although it's often thought to be addictive, that induces addiction. Okay, so let's not say that food is causing people to be addicted to it, which would be a bit like a chemical addiction. What we can see in what we do observe in certain individuals that suffer from severe obesity and, for example, binge eating disorder is actually a behavioral addiction, something more aligned to, you know, gambling or some other types of addiction, computer addiction. And so it's a behavioral disorder, really, in that case. But most people that claim to be food addicted are not actually food addicted. And the reason is also partly that when you start to apply all of the criteria for addiction, such as, you know, alcohol addiction, when you start to, you know, things like, you know, you develop tolerance over time and, you know, you crave, it's not really, you can't really show that those exist for food. But on the other hand, what we can see is that, you know, food is rewarding and there's a biological reason for it to be rewarding. But that doesn't mean to say you get addicted to it. I mean, if that was the case, I mean, it would be very detrimental to life because, I mean, we would all become addicted to food. What we do find is food pleasurable. And the downside of that is that, of course, eating in excess can be abused and a way to cope with stress or to sort of make people feel better. But now we're going into the realm of psychiatry, and for sure there is a role for psychiatrists in helping people who have these kinds of eating disorders and what would you say, addictive behavior towards food. But let's not blame the food. I think it's pretty difficult to say that food makes you addicted to it.
Yeah. So food is not an addictive substance in itself. I think that's very important to establish, but it's the way we behave when there's food around. And the same for physical exercise as well, because physical exercise is good for you, but sometimes people solve their problems or use it as a way of getting away from other more difficult aspects. And then overtraining can also be very harmful. Very nice. That was quite interesting. I can't avoid when I have two experts on the podcast and when we are talking about brain health and gut and so on, to ask you, what do you do in order to have a healthy diet or to have better brain health? We obviously see the bicycle in Hans' office. So, and as you said, Hans, you do a lot of exercise. But are there other things that you in specifically take care of in your daily life that you would say do this for my health or brain health?
Yeah, I try to follow the general concepts of what is told in Sweden as being a general good nutritional lifestyle, to having three regular meals, sit down and have the meal, try to have a meal together with someone so you actually put down your knife and fork and talk to each other during the meal, not eating too fast, in order to be able to feel when you're full before you're actually over full. But my biggest life hack when it comes to this is probably my morning, my breakfast, having oatmeal porridge at a young age. And I mean, that was just, it wasn't due to any health reason when I started out with it. But I mean, oatmeal porridge is probably a very good way to start your day if you want to have at least a big chunk of your fiber needs available already from the start of the day, with a good soluble fiber, which also in people who have troubles with a lot of symptoms from their bowels, they accept it more often that more, you can say, like the insoluble fibers. But I would say the way you eat is the way I try to, or the social circumstance eating, that I sit down and try to eat not too fast, is probably my life hack.
So I think a lot about what and how much I eat. And I think what I really struggle with is getting enough protein. And that's particularly bad because I also try to exercise. And I know that it's really important to keep your protein intake up. But what I've noticed, you know, is that being on a permanent diet is absolutely miserable, you know, when you kind of, like those monks used to sort of thrash themselves on their back. I've been one of those. Every time I eat something bad, I feel, oh, I shouldn't have eaten that. And I think as I've got older, I've tended to think that, well, I should really more adopt the French attitude, which is that treats are okay. You should be allowed treats sometimes. Well, don't feel bad about it, but don't eat them all the time. And another hack for me is portion size, because When I first started living with my husband and we had a young family, I always put the food on the table so that people could have as much as they want, which was all right for my skinny husband. But I think I started to overeat. What I do is actually to put the food on the plate in the kitchen and then bring it to the table and let anyone who wants to eat more go back to the kitchen if they want it. And I think for me, portion size is really very important, actually, to realize how much I actually need and to recognize that, you know, I've I'm full now. I don't actually need more. I would only be eating because I like it, not because I need it. My basic principle. And here in Sweden, we're quite lucky, as Hans mentioned, that the traditional sort of Swedish food, it's called, and sorry to introduce Swedish here, but husmanskost. traditional way of eating. And, you know, you've got your potatoes and you've got some green or some vegetables on your plate and you've got some protein, usually with a little bit of sauce on it to make it palatable. I mean, that kind of eating is pretty healthy and it's probably what we have in our regular diet at home, switching between meat, fish and chicken and seafood, which is absolutely wonderful on the west coast of Sweden.
We got some Swedish advertisement there as well. I think that's good. And thank you for sharing this. And I think it was very valuable advice. And it's also what you were saying, Hans, it's not too complicated, neither what you are saying nor Suzanne. It's doable because some of the diets that are commercially advertised are very complicated. And then people just can't follow them. But we are slowly summing up. But the last challenge for you, because we are talking much about the individual perspective, but I also would like to know if society, if politicians, government and so on, were to make decisions that would influence brain health and gut health in a positive way, what should they do? Do you have one suggestion if there is anybody listening to this podcast? What would you challenge them to do, Suzanne?
Well, I have to put on two hats here again, and I have 2 points. One is my hat as European Brain Council president, where we're continually lobbying for brain health and brain research. And I think, I mean, the cost to society of not having healthy brains is very severe. And in fact, what we need is to be able to treat people better. And therefore, I think any investment that is made in research will absolutely pay off in the long term. And I think there's so much we have to learn about the brain and how nutrition shapes it.
And what would you say to the Swedish government or to the EU? You should do this in order to promote.
I think there are some tough political decisions to be made, where we as professionals also need to provide them with the fundamenta that support these types of tough political decisions. And I think, as exemplified by Suzanne, when it comes to behaviors and so on, our behaviors are very much related also to cost. And I think that is, unfortunately, one of the ways we need to address how to eat healthier, that it actually should pay off to eat healthier. That it should be a bit more expensive to make choices that we for now know is less healthy than those that are healthy. I mean, we have neighboring countries where they have taxes on soda, for example, for lemonades and so on. That they actually, if they are these sugary drinks, you have an extra tax on that. And these are actually that's the way of diverting people to better food choices, even if it's not very popular. That's the problem. I think that's a basic thing that we could give advice about. But you also need to provide politicians with a good evidence for doing that, because they will get a lot of bad publicity from doing it. And then we need to support them.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Suzanne?
Yes, actually, that touched on my second point, is, of course, to lobby against pricing and cost of unhealthy food. I mean, you know, I haven't lived in America, but, you know, what you see is really that poor income families are really eating a lot of fast food and ready prepared foods. And there's very simple things that can be done to improve this kind of behavior. I mean, in young children, you can teach them what a healthy diet would look like, how to cook. You know, and you can give healthy choices in the canteen. And again, in Sweden, we do that. The children are often offered vegetables and salad as the first thing they have to put on their plate as they're queuing up in the lunch queue. And then they can supplement that with the rest of the foods that are available. I mean, there have been experiments, you know, in different countries taxing fat, I heard. I know that it was actually quite successful, but for some reason the government, I'm sorry, I don't remember the country, but the government abandoned it, and it's probably due to, what do you say, industry pressure, so from the food industry. There's a lot can be done there, but politicians, they need evidence and, you know, proving that, you know, a healthy diet is good for brain health or for health is actually incredibly difficult, as we've discussed today. And I think the more that scientists can have an opportunity through improved research opportunities to explore this, it's actually the only way ahead. So I come back then to my first point. We need more funding for understanding the research into nutrition and health and brain health.
Mm. So to sum up, money is an issue here. We need more funding, both in brain health and also in brain-gut connection and in gut health. Price matters. If you're supposed to take the wise choices, then you can't have chips much cheaper than apples, for instance, because that's the way it is. We need to nudge people to make wise choices. And we need to support them. Those of us who are in the medical community in different positions need to support both those who are going to take the unpleasant decisions, like putting taxes on lemonade. Thank you very much for being on this podcast, Suzanne Dixon and Hans Tornblom. I really learned a lot, and I hope that the listeners did too. And also for your way of presenting not only the guts, but the connection between the brain and the gut, and also having very important and very interesting reflections upon society, the individual perspective, and also what we should not continue to do. I thank you then again for joining us on the Brain Health Mission podcast, and also to the listeners, both of you who follow us on a regular basis and also the listeners that are new. And I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. And I hope that you will follow us on your preferred podcast platform. Share it with your network and stay tuned for more exciting conversations on brain health themes. There are more to come. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Brain Health Mission podcast, where science meets action for a healthier brain. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or your favorite podcast app so you never miss an update. For more tools, tips, and expert insights, head to brainhealthmission.org. That's brainhealthmission.org. Until next time, take care of your brain. It's the only one you've got.